Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko, best known from the Survival Podcast, today with you on the Permaethos blog, though. And this one is going to be, you know, not a podcast, just an audio update available at Permaethos. You may be listening to this, though, because you heard about it on some of the, you know, either the Survival Podcast blog or Facebook or what have you. But it's not really a podcast. It's just me explaining where we're going and what we're doing with Permaethos next to you guys and giving you some ideas about why we're doing it, why it'll work, and the thought that's gone into it, which has been immense. This is a good solid month since I would tell you it's really about 2 months of beating my head against the wall and how do we make the original idea work. And then about a month ago, thinking, change course, Jack. This is not... You know, the way to take this hill is not charging up the machine gun nest. We have to figure out another way to do this. And then about a month of that going around, carrying that in my mind and playing different scenarios in my head. And then a month ago, so about a month of doing that, and then sitting down on a whiteboard one morning at 8 o'clock in the morning, and there it is. And I know we're on the right track now, and I know we can make this work. And I know if some of you who were on board with doing it the other way will stick with us, that there's enough interest to fund this thing and to make it happen. And at the end of the day, I'm hoping that you'll think to yourself, I really want to be part of this. And I also think that maybe a lot of people who liked the idea that we had before, which we still want to do eventually, by the way, but it didn't work for them, will think, well, I can do this. This is something I can definitely do and like it a lot better. I want to... let you know that at probably tomorrow I'm going to put up a new survey like I did with for investors and leasees for the old project. This one's just going to be for this new project. Are you interested? If so, how far in do you want to go? And we'll take it from there. That'll gauge the size of the opportunity. And I believe that once we set up and start making a mechanism for people to invest, that it'll get even better from there. So if I can find that there's enough interest, we'll get this thing off the ground and get it going. I'm going to give you everything we have right now. It's not formal, but this is what we're formalizing. And I'm going to tell you where I need some help as well along the way today as well. I want to start off with why we changed course. Why did I take this brilliant idea of building an incredibly awesome permaculture community where people would all have about an acre, three quarters of an acre to an acre of their own land, huge community property, event center, and all this other stuff. When we have the money to do it, when we have the money to actually get it off the ground and get it going and then put it into a revenue model where there's enough people that want to buy in already, there's enough recurring revenue, and everything works. I mean, it works so perfectly, and there's so many people interested in investing in it. Why would you change your mind? Because it doesn't work. And it doesn't not work because of any of the things that we were planning on. It doesn't work because of government. In every place that we've gone, we see a large amount of infrastructure that has to be installed. Our ideas for making it not be a subdivision doesn't wash with government. Government wants everything to be a subdivision. We talked to Mike Reynolds' folks in New Mexico. They said and I've had a lot of people say, just do it, and then tell them come try to stop you or whatever. Mike Reynolds lost his architectural license and got over $2.5 million in fines. They highly suggested that we play ball in the line, so to speak. So we talked to civil engineers. One place that we found a really beautiful property, the county would want us to put at minimum a paved road through the entire property for right of access, which would be a $2 million investment in the road that we don't need. So the short answer is, for now, with no track record and no revenue and no history and no ability to get through the minds of bureaucrats, that model doesn't work for us at the scale we wanted to do it at. I think if somebody wants to do it on their own and you want to buy 20 acres and put maybe four or five small houses on it, I think you can get away with that. But I think to do what we wanted to do, to really make it sustainable with recurrent revenue and all, it doesn't work. So we're going to step back and we're going to redo it. But we're not abandoning the idea. In fact, we actually want to, in a way, make this idea eventually transition into a little piece of that so that we can take it and use it as a demonstration in negotiating with other counties and saying, hey, this is what we would do on a larger scale, so that they have something that they can see that we've done where we can prove it. If that doesn't work, then we make a million of these, each of them with its own micro community. One way or another, we get the community model done, but we need to do something that's going to work today. And what I came up with is the Perma Ethos Farm Model, based on 10 primary principles, several of which, if you know permaculture, you will have heard before, applied maybe a little bit differently here. The first principle is this farm must be based on voluntary association. And what I mean by voluntary association is I will not convince you to invest in Perma Ethos. I will not convince you in any way, shape, or form. If after we put out all the information we have, you say, I'm still not sold, I will tell you, do not invest. I do not want anybody sold on the idea. I want people to look at the idea and say, I want to be part of that. So that's number one. Bigger, though, true voluntary association means I don't take anything from anybody who didn't want to give it to me. So Perma Ethos will never take a tax dollar or a government subsidy or a government grant. One, not a penny, none. Perma Ethos will not be tethered to subsidies. Will not say, well, I'd like to do this more, better, but if I do, then I'll lose my subsidy and I'll lose my farm. We're not going to do that. And besides, tax dollars are taken from people without their consent. There is no way an organization can be a voluntary organization if they're taking other people's money who did not agree to give it to them. So that right there says that we have to go to the private sector, and we have to ask for people that believe in what we're doing to be involved with us by their free will. We will take a grant if a private entity who's earned their money in the private sector puts up an agricultural grant and says you can compete for this grant. We will absolutely compete for any grant like that. And if there's anything in our space, we'll probably have a very good job of getting it. But that money was voluntarily donated. So right from the get-go, voluntarist association only with the Perma Ethos Farm. Next, care of the earth, which is, you know, one of the three permaculture ethics. And the next thing, the next three are all the permaculture ethics. We will use no toxic chemicals. We will build soil. We'll retain soil. There is nothing that we will do on a Perma Ethos farm that will harm the planet. With intelligence as well, though. We're looking for a 40 to 80 acre property with a house on it to house our farm steward and to put on a couple smaller dwellings to handle our tenant farmers. There are purists who would say unless you have 100% solar and wind, you're not permaculture because you're burning fossil fuels and killing the polar bears and what have you. We're looking at buying existing structures that already have grid electricity so that we can get the farm up and running. The goal over the long term is to transition into as much clean, green energy as possible. But we will not cut off our nose to spite our face. We will not take the money of our investors in the first 2 years when we're trying to get the farm profitable and off the ground and buy $30,000 worth of solar panels that won't do in those next couple years what a few hundred dollars worth of electricity will do. Because it's not a prudent fiscal move. But nothing we do will be damaging to the land that we're on or the land around us. And everything that we produce will be produced healthy so that when it's distributed, it does no harm to anywhere that it goes. The next thing is care of people. We will make sure that anybody that's a helper on our property, works for our property, anybody that's a supplier or a buyer is treated ethically. We will not beat down a supplier to the lowest penny just to make a better profit. If we have a supplier of something, we will deal with them fairly because we want them to be there to continue to supply us. We will treat our customers ethically. We will never harm people on a Perma Ethos farm. The next thing is return of surplus. After a period of probably 2 to 3 years at least, because the farm has to build its stability, the surplus from a financial standpoint will be returned to our investors. So, and I'll lay that out for you later exactly how that works, but a portion of all profits will be paid back to those people that help us establish the farm in the first place. And that's probably a small piece to a lot of people. But over time, I believe that everybody that invests in us can recover their investment and we can create ongoing long-term return of surplus investment. I'm going to tell you right now, even though I'm going to say it later, do not do this to get rich. You probably will not get rich with this. But if we can get it off the ground, we might have the ability to establish many of them And if we establish many of them, it may provide a valid annuity for people long term. And it may not. We could fail. But whatever surplus is produced will be distributed to our members. The next one, number 5, no secrets. There will be no secrets. There will be nothing proprietary. Everything developed on the PermaEthos farm will be done under open source protocols. If we come up with a new way to build some kind of a tool, we will publish every single thing that we have on how that tool was built. We will protect it under open sources so that no one can ever patent it, so that anybody that wants to use it can, including our competitors, and hopefully more people will choose to cooperate with us and compete with us in using whatever we put out. We will put out anything that we determine about plants and what works and what doesn't, how to propagate a particular species or get a certain type of seed to germinate, or the results of creating any kind of cross-pollination. You won't hear us talk about special seed, but then not tell you what it is, like many people, or I should say a small number of people that are highly well known in the permaculture industry. Oh, I have this. This is awesome. Well, what is it? I can't tell you. No. Whatever we produce, we will tell you how it's produced. And whatever we can produce in enough stock to be able to distribute, we will sell at a fair market rate to members at a discount and to anybody else at a fair market retail price. No secrets in any technologies, planning methodologies, building construction technologies, every single thing documented and available under open source protections, the Linux of permaculture. Next, open accounting. Common sense. Basically, all members will be provided quarterly copies of all our accounting records, what's earned, what's spent, where their money is, how it's done. And members will be able to make some decisions in their voting privileges we'll talk about later based on that knowledge and what's going on the farm. But basically accountability back to those who've placed the seed investment in the organization. Next, obtain a yield. We are running these farms to make a profit. We are not running them to save polar bears. We are not doing them to conjure mud fairies. We are not doing them so that everybody will sing kumbaya and sit around in a circle and rock back and forth and contemplate their navel. We are doing this to make a profit for ourselves and for the members. And because it is the only viable model to make permaculture as an industry sustainable, the farms have to be able to make money. And anybody that doesn't understand that doesn't get it, and they're probably trying to figure out why they can't get anything done. These farms are not made to make anybody filthy rich, but they are designed to make enough profit to be sustainable, to continue to grow, and to become more profitable in the future so as to spawn more of them. People do not go in business to lose money. People do not go in business to work a job like a maniac to make the same money they would work as a manager at McDonald's. This is a for-profit farm. It is not non-profit, and nothing under PermaEthos name is going to be done in a 501c3 or any other crap like that. These farms are designed to make a profit, because if permaculture is the best system in the world to produce high-quality food and high-quality systems, then it should be very profitable. It's in its infancy. It's going to take time to prove the concepts out and to really systematize them to the point where they're replicatable at this scale. But it's all about a profit. It's not only about a profit, it's all about a profit. Here's what I mean by that. We want to do good things. We want to care for the earth. We want to care for people. We want to spread the knowledge that we have. We want to reinvest in our communities. We want to put better food on the plates of the average person and make that more affordable to people by increasing its availability. We want to do all those things, and we want to make a profit. But if we don't make a profit, we can't do those things. If we don't make a profit, then we are supported by charity, and we are only as viable as the charity line continues, and we are subject to the whims of those with the charity checkbook, and we will have to make our decisions, and we will have to compromise based on the availability of charity funds. That is not what this is. That's why profit is important. The next thing, teach and spread permaculture. These farms are designed to be educational and community outreach programs, to run full-on earthworks workshops where people come from all around and pay good money to learn how to do swales and dams and things like that. But to also be a place where a local teacher, for no money at all, can bring the children of her class and see a real working farm done the right way, where the animals are treated well and the plants that are grown are healthy, and you don't have to put a mask on them so they can walk through a field that was just sprayed. So teach and spread permaculture. That's part of the open source concept as well. But these are educational systems designed to both profit from education and do education as a giving back. Principle 9, improving our community. We will donate 10% of all surplus, and that could be money or it could be food to the hungry. But 10% of the total surplus of the farm every year, understanding that we may not make a profit the first year and have a surplus to give, but we will give 10% of the surplus to local community charities at every Perma Ethos farm, especially the first one. And here's the big thing. We will have our farm steward and our tenant farmers and our woofers who are working with the community figure out where they think the money should go. And then come back to the members. Every person that's invested, every share that they purchase, they have one vote for. If you purchase 10 shares, you get 10 votes. And say, here's the people that we think we can help. And the members will approve the distribution to charity. So you're actually deciding who gets that level of return. Somebody's not making you do it. I'm telling you going in, we're going to do this. I'm going to tell you it's going to cut into your bottom line because I believe it's the right thing to do. And I think that if we are a part of a local community and we are giving to food banks and we are teaching children in schools, that we are far less likely to eventually be attacked by that same local government and put out of business. That it's the right thing to do, plus it's in our own best interest. And when something turns out to be both of those, you are a fool if you do not act on it. It is a bad business principle, and it is a bad humanitarian principle. So we will make an investment in our community so that they will feel invested in us. Next, replicate. The tenant farmers on this. So the way I have this designed now, there's one primary farm steward. We'll call them a head farmer. In this first one, unless something radically changes in the next couple months as we're building this up, it will be my intern, Josiah, who's worked with me directly now for 7 months, and we'll be doing this for several more months before his internship comes to a close here. I can't think of anybody I trust more or better suited to do this job. There'll be two tenant farmers. Those two tenant farmers will be in positions where they'll be paid a lower wage but basically have all of their needs met. They will learn every single component of the farm. And in this case, they'll be learning together because nobody's done this before. This is the pioneering team. But the goal is for those folks to leave at the end of a year and both of them do this again. And both of them to bring in two more tenant farmers, and that's four. And the end of that year to do it again. That timeline may be a tad too accelerated for the first one. It may take 2 years. If the person's up for it. But we're looking from those people a minimum 1 year commitment, place to stay, meals provided, small stipend, work, develop, learn, build systems. Go out and replicate. Become a founder of your own next farm. And we will support those people when they leave by going back to our investors and saying, this worked well enough that we can do another one. Let's do another one. Let's do another one. Let's do another one. Let's do another one and continue to attract outside investors into this community. And every single farm that goes into the black, every single farm that becomes profitable and returns anything back to the investors increases our strength to be able to continue to do it. That's the vision. And I think that it's completely and totally doable. How will it work? We think we need at least $500,000 to do this. When we start looking at properties that have a decent house, and hopefully we find something that's got like a second guest house or something to immediately provide, you know, some type of housing to our tenant farmers and save that expense. You know, we look and we see stuff from real low end, like 180 up to more like 300, 350. And we want to keep the purchase of the property itself under $300,000. And again, this is 40 to 80 acres. It's got to be somewhere with reasonable internet access so that we can run the business beyond just the farming. And it has to be somewhere reasonably close to a decent-sized town to permit to provide for marketing opportunities, because one of the best places to sell is not to the farmer's market but to restaurants and to boutique shops. So it's got to have that going for it. And as we look around, there is a lot of property that fits that description from about – most of it is in the neighborhood of $250,000 to $350,000. So that – if we can get it under $300,000, that leaves us 2 years of operating budget – with construction, with earthworks, with plants, with seeds, with livestock, with feed, with equipment, all of the stuff that we're going to need, and paying a wage to three people of about $200,000. Sounds like a lot of money, but when you start adding it all up, it's at the edge of what will work with some degree of certainty that we'll be able to make this work. So that's the basic fundraising. 1,000 shares at $500 a share. We haven't decided yet whether or not we are going to limit how many shares somebody can buy. Again, I need a good CPA and a lawyer. I'll talk more about that later. But that may have something to do with how we keep this thing from being full on, you know, Federal Trade Commission regulated. I don't know if this is done as common stock, if it's done as a membership share. I need a good attorney to formalize the membership or shareholder agreement for me in a way that protects both parties equitably. So that's something that's still up in the air, but we think that will work. Additionally, the founder would be myself and Josiah and possibly the tenant farmers. We will set aside an initial bank of shares that we can purchase with a minimal investment that I have to put in, that I have to make at least that minimum. We haven't set that number yet, but it's a significant investment since I'm asking others to invest. But we get to buy our shares at 20% of market rate, kind of like options in founding a company. Nothing unethical or unusual about that at all, but that's one of our perks, and I'll talk more about that in a bit. But that's basically, that would be additional capital infused into the company. So I'll leave that for now because there's certain things that I'm at risk for that members are not, that we'll get to later on in another section. I'll stick to how the farm will actually work. And again, it'll be run by a farm steward, two tenant farmers, and woofers. We plan on putting together some kind of bunkhouse style facilities for woofers as quickly as possible. They may be a little hot or a little cold depending on the time of the year it is, but it's short-term housing, and we'll look at improving that depending on the participation level we get. But we want to make sure that our farm steward and two tenant farmers have a good roof over their head, have an air conditioner, have a heater, have a good shower, have a good bathroom. And then again, a living wage. And it's probably not a lot of money, to make sure that most of the money stays capitalized into the operations of the farm, but enough to make sure that they can live on it. We do have to think about trying to turn a profit on at least the initial operations as quickly as possible. What I mean by that is there's no way we're going to turn a profit on the total investment in the first 6 months. It's impossible. There's no way you're going to pick up 40 to 80 acres and turn it into and pull $300,000 back out of it just on the purchase price of the property in the first year. It is not doable. What is doable is, okay, well, here's what we had to pay to buy the property. Here was the improvements, the equipment we had to make, et cetera. Now, here's animals, here's a feed bill, here's the day wages prorated across the time period, here's the production in the end. That should be profitable. That absolutely should be profitable in the first year. And the way to make it happen, and I'll be consulting with Darby Simpson from Simpson Family Farms on this, but it's going to be pastured poultry, eggs from pastured poultry, and pork. And I believe those three things are the most profitable and doable items that we can get on right away with most of the land we've looked at. We'll support those operations initially, and they can be used to help establish the long-term systems that will be going on that property. We'll be throwing earthworks into these systems right away, creating paddocks and cells for cell grazing, planting food forests, all of that stuff. But those things are second, third, fourth year profitability things. That initial livestock quotient can prove profitable quickly. Pastured poultry is a very profitable business right now. It's not something you get filthy rich in, though you get filthy and you can make some money. You get filthy for a different reason, though, just from the work itself. But it's doable. It has the least amount of USDA regulations in the way of it over most things. The birds grow relatively fast. There's a lot of breeds that work well for this. The techniques are known and defined. They are consistent with permaculture practices and principles, but yet you don't have to have a full-on permaculture site, which is, you can get a site into that in a couple acres quick. Getting 80 acres into it's going to take more time. This is a ramp-up, profitable initial stage. But there's another goal that's going on at the same time. We want those things done for profit. The farm needs to be built initially with the goal that every farm was built with 100 years ago, and no farm has basically been built with since 1950. The first real primary goal is to feed the farmers. We want a farm that our tenant farmers, our woofers, and our head farm steward and their families, if they live there with them, can at least feed themselves. They could do some of that with the poultry, the eggs, and the pork. But a lot of other things need to be done to make that happen. Kitchen gardens and things like that, that become breeding grounds for the propagation of seed stock for larger scale production and plant stock for larger scale production, both for our own planting on the larger scale and for sale to the outside community. And that is something that we've lost. And the reason that we have to go out and fundraise $500,000 to put one farm like this in place is because that was lost. That's why. Because it's impossible now to go in on a shoestring and build something like this long and survive long enough to make it happen. Because it used to be in the homesteading days, you just went and did it. And the cost of entry was relatively low. Now it's all gone factory. It's the thing that we bitch about all the time is the problem. I believe this is the solution to that. Because once we prove the concept, again, we can replicate it over and over again. So feed the farmers is the next component to making it work. Then we also have to be smart. We will grow some things that we produce in large quantities that sell well simply because it's grown in a permaculture farm and it's all natural and it's really great high quality stuff. But we also need to grow some exotic and premium foods. To give you an example of some of the things I'm thinking about, there is a technology to develop greenhouses that are built into the ground. We can build these in a quarter acre and up. We could do them relatively low cost because the walls are dirt. They are extremely temperature stable. They allow you to grow things like you're in the tropics, even in North Texas. In fact, you can do it further north than here. Where we're at, you really can do it. We can put in some of these and we can grow some exotic perennial crops like coffee. We can grow an exotic coffee in the Texas market and go to a brewery in the Texas market, just as one possible example, and say, we want to be the coffee supplier for your next premium beer. I'm talking about the beer that you buy in a bottle the size of a wine bottle that sells for $14 to $20 a bottle. And for them to be able to come out with an exotic coffee stout made with Texas coffee and be the only brewer in the world that can do that, that's a premium product. That's the edge. I don't know that everything we do will go to that far to the edge, but that's what I'm thinking. The same thing could be done in the same type of a greenhouse environment with vanilla orchids. Texas vanilla. It does not exist. These greenhouses can be large enough in time, permacultured, not monocultured greenhouses, permacultured greenhouses, polycultured greenhouses, that we can actually put bees into them and control the type of pollen they're getting and market exotic honeys. That's one niche. There's other things that we can do. There's definitely other things that we can do. If you've ever tried to find red jalapenos, that's hard in itself. I've proven that can be done, getting 80 to 90% of your production to be red. There's a market for that too. And that's the other edge. It's not that special, but it's still kind of cool. There's all different levels between those variables, and a lot of it we will not figure out until we get on the ground and start doing it. In the beginning, it's going to be get the pig tractors and the chicken tractors in place, get the rotation going on, get them going, develop a system, develop a market, make it profitable, and start building these other things as peripherals. But those are the types of things that we can do because we don't want to be in the business, oh, we sell organic corn. That is not what this is about, and that will not be profitable. It's not going to work. So we need to do things like develop systems of growing multiple different salad greens that are sold by the pound on an order and receive within 24 to 48 hours to boutique restaurants. These are the types of things that are profitable, that are proven profitable and already being done. They're in the middle. So we go from edge to middle to mundane edge, but we stick to the niche product. We stick to the product that sells at a premium, where there's already buyers that are willing to pay a premium. We could do a lot of other things in time that are more commodity-based, but to develop the profitability, we go to these areas first. All right. The next thing we do, develop long-term food forestry. A food forest can put more production out per acre than just about any other system in the world in total pounds. You're looking at a 3 to 8 year ramp-up period in this climate. We have to pay the bills in the interim. That's why we're doing other creative things, but that is the long-term goal. To have systems that can produce massive amounts of food that we may run eventually, mostly as U-pick operations, where people come out and pick their own food, reducing the cost of labor and having the ability to deal with gluts through simply bringing in more people. And if we don't bring enough people in, harvesting and selling off to premium suppliers. Again, there's a huge niche industry growing around mead right now. Apples grown in Texas are not that common. There's probably a lot of mead makers that'd be interested in producing a sizer from Texas honey and Texas apples. And there's an entire micro, almost a nano brewery and venting industry coming up in many states now for very small boutique brewers and venters to do things if they use products from within their state. So there's a lot of opportunity in that one little niche alone. And that comes, again, though, from the long-term and the short-term visions being put together. Next thing is, again, as I said before, all tenant farmers are intensive training for supported replication. If a tenant farmer on this farm needs to know everything the head farmer knows, especially on the first one. But they're developing the system together the first time around. But once it's systematized, our hope is that if Joe has a tenant farmer with him named Bob, 1 year from now, 2 years maximum, Bob is stepping out and saying, this is the piece of land I want to buy. I've got my playbook now. I helped write it. I need two tenant farmers. I need woofers. I need some money. Let's go. Get me some investors. Let's go. And he'll build his farm twice as fast as the first one. And then a year from then, he's got two tenant farmers going out and doing it again. And if you start to do the math on that, even with reasonable success, conservative success, it gets very exciting very quickly. And we're not going to hamper anybody from going out and doing this on their own. We will make the playbook available to anybody. But we will make the support on the fundraising available to people who have completed a tenant farmer internship or to people that have worked closely with us in some other way that we have confidence in. And based on the availability of funds as well, of course. But that's our goal. This is not about one farm. This is about 100 farms. This is about 1,000 farms. This is about restoring agriculture to its traditional role in America, feeding Americans that they know. So this is really something special. And you know, this kind of a part here in the audio to pause and just say, hey, if I didn't run into the roadblocks with the community idea, we wouldn't have this now. I would have never come up with this. There's a reason everything happens. Just kind of point that out for a second. And then profits are returned to the shareholders and members. So I'll talk about the breakdown of that in a bit. But basically, that's the end goal, that by the time this is all done, it's up and running for a couple of 3 years. You get to the end of the third year. You run the books. You look at it. You say, well, here's the profit. Here's all the shares. Shares divided by profit. Profit's a dividend. Payments go out to the members. And then every year thereafter, as long as the farm is profitable, that happens. And those numbers should go up. Should, like it should rain or it should not rain tomorrow. I cannot guarantee anything except we'll do 100% of what we can to make it succeed. Financial breakdown. Here's the expenses we're looking at. Initially, the land and house purchase. Again, we're thinking $300,000. A living wage for the steward and the tenant farmers. I don't know how many takers we'll have at the tenant farmer position when I get done with what I'm about to say, but we're probably looking at a situation where the head farmer's making about $20,000 to $25,000 a year. And, you know, he's going to be responsible for those tenant farmers. There's absolutely no way that at some point in time he won't be picking some stuff up at the grocery and all, because even though we're going to be growing food, you're only going to grow so much so fast at first, and you can only eat so much of one thing. He's going to kind of be a fatherly figure to those tenant farmers, especially when you hear what they're going to end up with. Probably $500 a month, $6,000 a year, well below the poverty line, but no electric bill, no phone bill, no nothing except learn. This is going to be like going to college to learn how to farm and getting paid to do it. I mean, that's the way to look at it. This is an investment in yourself and your future. And we are trying to figure out how to structure this. And this is something I need to talk about with a CPA and a lawyer again. How to pay that person beyond that and have them pay the money back as a farm-to-farm lease so that when they do leave, if they don't want to go the fundraiser route, if they just say, I know enough now, I want to build a farm like this, but I don't want all this members and all this other stuff, and they want to go to a bank and say, I want to borrow money and establish an agricultural presence, and they find a piece of agriculturally zoned land, they can walk in with a Schedule F, which is the IRS form for reporting farm income, and show history farming. Well, it's important to us, too, that we don't saddle that person who dedicates as much of their time and effort to us with only one way to go forward. We want them to have as many options as possible. And any other ways we can figure out how to structure things that will increase their options when they leave, we will do. We will invest in them because they've invested in us. Care of people. The next one is equipment. We're going to need a tractor. We're probably going to need to find at least like an old backhoe or something we can get at a decent price to do a lot of the stuff without having to always lease equipment and bring it in. We will have equipment leasing costs with mainframe earthworks projects. It doesn't make sense to purchase an excavator. With what you can rent one for and the amount of work you can get out of them in 3 or 4 days and not be responsible for their maintenance after that, it doesn't make sense. So we probably won't be, you know, purchasing any major excavation equipment or anything like that. But we need some basic equipment, some trailers to move stuff around, and we're going to need things like fencing materials, electronet fencing. All this stuff adds up and costs a lot of money to get off the ground. You realize, well, so many farmers are broke, and they can barely make a living because they're always borrowing money to do all this stuff, and they're always having to pay it back relatively quickly at a substantial interest payment. So we're trying to circumvent that. Livestock. You know, we want to put a bunch of birds out on this place right away. They're not free. They do return a profit to you, but they cost money. And you got to feed them. So a feed for livestock, because there's no way you're going to buy a piece of land, especially initially, and feed them 100% off the land. That's difficult to do in the best case scenario. Joel Salatin feeds grains to his chickens. They probably get 60 to 70% of their diet off the land, but he still supplements their diet. And if he didn't, he'd have a real problem, you know, staying profitable. So there is that initial ramp up in that first year cost of that before there's any revenue coming in on the other side. Plants and seed. The plant budget is going to be enormous if we're going to get this done fast. I mean, if it's going to take 3 to 5 years to establish a food forest, you want to plant it in year 1 to year 2. You don't want to plant it in year 4. So that leads to a point where we have to establish as much of it as we can as quickly as possible and then use cuttings and graftings and seed propagation to extend it. And that way, we can start to see the return as quickly as possible. All eyes are going to be on this. There's going to be people rooting for this to fail. I'll tell you right now, there's going to be people in conventional agriculture going, I can't wait to see this thing fail. Well, good luck. But that means we need to showcase it. We need to make it dramatically successful, dramatically quickly. And we can do it, but it takes that investment initially to make sure we have the things to plant. And then infrastructure improvement. I mean, if we're going to have woofers, we're going to need a bunkhouse. If we're going to, and one of the most profitable things we can do in the first couple of years is workshops. We're going to put in 2,000 feet of swale. Well, hell, you know what? When I did an earthworks workshop here, people came and paid good money for it. We could bring a larger property. We could, you know, seat 50, 60 students. That could be profitable. That could make a good wage for the farm and start to put money straight back into the development, offset the installation expenses, and relatively quickly start to create a surplus that can be distributed to, you know, our folks that are investing in this. So that's what the financial breakdown is, basically. Profit distribution. Okay, when we have a profit, let's say we're in our third year now, we've gotten through our two-year incubation period, it's time to start distributing some profit. Even when there's a profit at the end of that year, when you look at the third year, so we get to our 24th month, we have a profit of X. We can't distribute all of that profit. We know there's going to be ongoing expenses through the third year. So the first thing we do is a forecast of how much money we're going to need to maintain operations in the third year. So that's a financial reserve. Any business that doesn't do that ends up bankrupt. That you have to do that, and you have to budget a little beyond your projected revenue as well. So we have that monetary reserve as the first bucket that things go to. Production bonuses to farmers. You got guys working for almost nothing. They do a kick-ass job. They make a farm a bunch of money. A significant chunk of that is paid to them as a wage because now they're self-sufficient, right? And hopefully by the time you get into third year, fourth year, these guys are on 100% production compensation, right? So a tenant farmer, you know, that goes first, man, you're going to have it hard. But in an active, working, hard-charging farm, you have a much bigger piece of the pie because there's a pie to cut up as it's developed. So wages paid is a production bonus. They're the guys doing the work every day. They should be the first one kind of at the jar. And then charity to local community. And that could be product or mandatory, monetary. But we are going to distribute something to our local community so that we are valued before we worry about profit for ourselves. And then the remainder is distributed to the shareholders. So as you can see, I told you don't do this to get rich. This is not about keeping three guys working for the at the poverty level forever so that we can make as big a return as we can as farmers without ever getting our fingernails dirty. This is about the establishment of self-replicating permaculture farms that do return surplus to us, but first take care of those who do the majority of the work in a very ethical and a very thought out manner. So that's the profit distribution. The first site goals. This is over 2 to 5 years. This is what I want this site to achieve in its first 2 to 5 years of existence. One, I want to prove the concept profitable. If at the end of 2 years I can go this year, we're paying everybody a dividend of $10 a share. So you put in $500, you get $10 back. I'm happy. I'd like to do better. I might do better. I don't know that I will, but I would be happy because you know what I'd be able to say then? You know what we did? In 2 years, we established a farm. We paid somebody a living wage. We trained two people to do it well. If we're paying a dividend like that, all three parties earn something extra. We've established a working farm. It's debt-free. We have two people ready to go out and replicate it and do it again and again and again. And at this point, going forward, it's 100% self-sufficient, and the people that made the early investment can expect to receive a dividend for the rest of the farm's existence. And if here's a good thing I left out of my outline. Let's say we decide we want to sell this farm. Then we would do a distribution to the members based on shares. So if the farm got sold because it became worth so much money, it made sense to go ahead and sell this off to a private concern and use the money to replicate and make more of them. Every person that's invested, just like if you own stock in a company and the company sold, your shares are bought out. I'd like to make it difficult to do that, but I don't want to make it impossible because you never know when there might be a compelling reason to do so, a very compelling reason, and the ability to use the profitability to make a lot better decisions long term, especially when you have more than one. Don't get emotionally attached to any investment when it comes down to it, especially real estate. Even something that I'm going to be this emotionally attached to because this is going to be like a child to me. The next thing is I want to make mistakes. I want to screw up. I want to be able to say, that sounds like a great idea. It doesn't work. Don't do it. Here's everything we did. If you think you can make it work, don't do any of this stuff. Start with all of this knowledge. We want to make our mistakes totally open source, right? Not just our successes. So we want to document everything and make sure that the person that builds PermaEthos Farm number 2 avoids all of those mistakes. Because we're going to do some things nobody else has done before, and you can't do that without making mistakes. We want to replicate as swiftly as possible. I would very much prefer that our tenant farmers at the end of year 1 are building PermaEthos 2 and 3. And I think it can be done. As long as the farm is far enough along that we can bring in their replacements, and I think there's some overlap, there's probably a 30-day overlap where we're helping those two guys establish themselves, and they're still on our farm, and they have two new tenant farmers that are right beside them like their own apprentices. And that's helping them learn to go to that next level, because up till that point, they've been running woofers. Now they're going to be running people just like themselves, and that's a big adjustment. So that would get the tenant farmers up to speed, and you're looking at least the farm steward at least 2 years being there, and then maybe being replaced, if they want to be. If they want to go out and maybe found another Perma Ethos, because they may very want to come out and be a true founder this time. This is designed for upward mobility of everybody involved. There is no top of the pyramid. It's a very small pyramid when you think about it. You got farm steward, tenant, farmers, woofers. That's it. That's the whole pyramid. Right? Where you got a corporate job, you got 15 layers of middle management in between you and the CEO. So this is designed to be much, much different, to provide very fast upward mobility to the people that want to do it. And to provide people a situation where if all they want to do is be a farmer, that we can make that a job again. That somebody just, I just want to stay in one of these places. I want to love it like it's my own, even though it's community owned. I want the community to value me until I'm to the point where I want to retire and I want to stay here. Or if they want to go out and develop their own, that's fine. So then there's that. The next thing is I want to transition it into a micro eco village. This is my evil plan to take over the world. What we're thinking is that on a farm this size, we can probably put in quite a few buildings that would be off-grid, that would be sustainably built off-grid, and we can then rent those to people on a long-term lease, just like the original Perma Ethos, that we may be, in fact, able to divide out some lots on the edge along a road frontage that makes our infrastructure costs low, and put in 8 or 10 houses. People would come. They wouldn't have an acre of their own. It doesn't work that way here. But have a small land lease fee, build their own home. We're not sure how it would work yet. But what we would like to do is eventually get a farm who part of its business is seeing to tenants who occupy some of the land and who participate on some level on the farm, who are a community and part of the farm. Almost like a little town. Very, very small micro town. I'm not sure exactly how that works yet. I think when you get a piece of land, you start to figure out how that works. And that's something that the county commissioner clowns don't get. Well, how would this subdivision look? I don't know. Until I own a piece of land, I don't know how to design it. Well, we want to see a full design before we'll even tell you whether you can do it or not. Okay, well, I can't spend $1 million worth of people's money then. So in this instance, what we can do is slowly work this in, make this really, really beautiful, and maybe do that in a couple places, and then be able to put a portfolio together and take these micro ones and make them into a macro one someday. But you know, probably 5 years away from that. But I think this is how we get there. I want to be able to have more than just three families or three people living on these places. I want to make them microcosms of the original vision, but we build the farm into a productive, profitable enterprise first. And we build the farm into the community first, so that the community's not in opposition to what we're doing because we're the people that show up and help. All right? So that's another goal. The next one, I want to provide plants and materials for replication sites. I want the second one of these, third one of these, fourth one of these that are built to have their bill for establishment just plummet. I want to be like, well, we want to plant 400 apple trees. Yeah, here's 400 cuttings. Go plant them. So that's a huge goal. And then, but man, I got to tell you, as you're developing these, that power becomes greater and greater and greater. So that anything done under the Perma Ethos goal, label, brand, if you're a Perma Ethos farmer, you come in as a tenant farmer, you go through your rigorous educational program, you learn to farm, you go out and you build your own farm, you're committed to doing that too. If you're a Perma Ethos farm and there's another one being established, if you can help them, you help them. You choose how and you choose what. And as we build more and more of them, you'd have a new farm saying these are our needs. And hopefully everybody's saying I can do this. Not one trying to do it all. But the first one, mine, will do everything it can to see to more of them being established. And I believe that not only is it the right thing to do, it's the most profitable thing to do long term. Because as the farms grow, the brand grows, and the demand for production from any PermaEthos farm grows. Plants, seeds, education, all of it grows. This is like an unconglomerated conglomerate. Each one independently owned and operated. None of them paying a fee back to like the franchise home. But everybody sharing the knowledge of what works with each other. It's radical, but I think it'll work. Revenue. Let's talk about where the money comes from. I'm going to go fast with this. It's been a long day for me already. I think I'm probably longer than I planned, about 50 minutes. So the revenue production from pastured poultry and eggs, as I said, pastured pork. Those are your early on revenue. Beef and lamb, likely in the second year. Beef is a 18-month to 24-month product to go to full market with. We want to put some dairy in this as well on the cattle side. Lamb is a much better product in Texas than goat. It's more marketable. It sells better. There's better animals for the job. There's higher yields. There's less dealing with them escaping. And they're easier to deal with overall. Specifically, Dorpers are a great animal for our climate. So I'm not saying this would be true of an Ethos farm, let's say in Wyoming, but an Ethos farm in Texas, that would be probably the best compadre to the beef. We'll sell plants and seeds. We will do educational workshops, certainly on site, and maybe some electronic stuff too. What a great site to do a documentary series off of. And if that documentary series goes into DVDs or electronic format to be sold online, the profit goes to PermaEthos Inc. It's distributed to PermaEthos Inc. members or shareholders, however you want to call it. So that's another way that we can make some revenue. And I know at least with the first one, we can make money on workshops, because if I can make it on my house, you know, here on my property, if I can run workshops and turn a profit, we can definitely do it on a larger scale. I know we have the market for that. So I know if nothing else, in the first year, we can grow some chickens, we can grow some pigs, and we can run some classes. And we can put some money back into the thing to start making it self-sufficient. I know we can do that. We will do niche products and high-end produce, like I talked about already, so I won't say again. We're going to do in-house, in-ground greenhouse production of exotics and off-season items. So we want to build greenhouses into the earth. Can't do it here on my property, but trust me, anything we buy to do this with will not be like my property as far as subsoil. So that, we're going to do ecotourism. One of the first things we really want to do is start figuring out, you know, what is the cheapest that we can put in a nice little tiny house for? Even plugged into the grid, right? Little mini air conditioner in there, little work, desk to work on a laptop, nice little bed, little TV. Just a nice little place to stay and sleep. 10 by 10, maybe. We can probably build those for under $10,000 a piece. We can build a couple, three of those, and we can start renting them out to people. $100 a day, X amount, you know, maybe $600, $700 a month for people that want to come semi-long term and stay there. Woofers want to come. They don't want to stay in the bunkhouse. They're not getting paid. Some people actually, though, would say, you know what, I'd come for 2 weeks and rent one of those. We can build more of those subject to demand, up to a couple, half a dozen of them. Eventually, they may transition into the micro-eco-village. We don't know. But we can create a revenue stream off of those as well. And we think that could be very, very profitable in time. We'll definitely do a vineyard. Probably not like the typical vineyards that you see where it's all grapes and rows and lines. But we'll develop a permaculture vineyard, which I have some ideas for. And we'll either do our own wine by obtaining our own license to do so, or get a contract with a boutique winery. That's much more profitable business than selling grapes to Kroger. And honey. I think honey is one of the most dependable and profitable things that we can do. And as we build that side up, the opportunity from the bees' ability to forage on our property alone is enormous. Let's talk about member and shareholder benefits. Number one, voting rights. For every share you have, you get one vote. Like a typical corporation. I don't know if it'll be in the form of common stock or some type of membership, like a gun club. I don't know how. I need to talk to an attorney to figure that out, but you'll have voting rights. What you'll vote on will be dependent upon what we as the founders and the board of directors put up subject to a vote. In other words, not everybody votes on everything. But when we have major decisions to be made, like what portion of the revenue do we declare as a bonus to our farmers this year, that goes to shareholder vote. I'm trusting you to be ethical with that. And I'll go, none. I don't think that that would happen. So, and it may be more of a guidance issue. Like, we'll say, okay, well, we're thinking this percent. We go as low as this percent, as high as this percent. This is what these guys did. This is why we're thinking about it. Either approve or vote for the lower or higher amount. So it's not like you're going to be voting on, you know, what grape do we grow? We have to make decisions like that based on availability and markets and things like that. But we might at some point. We might have an edgy thing. We might have two edgy projects. We can do this or we can do that. And we go, man, both of these are risk plays. We're taking risk capital. We're associating it with this risk play. Might go out and write up a business plan for both of them. Come back to the shareholders and say, guys, you have until March 15th to vote. On March 15th, we're doing one of these two things. But you will have voting rights, and it will be based on your investment. So a person that's invested in 20 shares gets 20 votes. A person that's bought one share gets one vote. Again, that's typical. Founders, I'm thinking we invest $5,000 minimum. So I'm thinking I'm on the hook for at least that. I also have to see the fundraising, and if you become a tenant farmer and go out and do this in the future, you are primarily responsible for your fundraising. It doesn't mean you won't get the support of the Ethos community, the TSP community, the AgriTrue community, but I mean, you're the one that's got to do it. You've got to learn enough to be able to do everything I'm going to do in this first one and everything Joe's going to do in this first one on your own and just get our support versus us doing it for you, right? And that means we have to do that this first time around. And it'll be harder for us than it'll be for you, honestly. Founders appoint the farm steward and the tenant farmers. So as the founder of this one, I get to pick my farmer and my tenant farmers. I get to review the applications. I may rely on Joe to do a lot of the interviewing since he's going to be the one working with them directly. But in the future, as we build more of them, that would be, a perk, I guess you would say. I have the right to do that since this is my farm I'm establishing. Here's where it's not so good. As I said, since there'll be no debt on this thing, if it completely craps the bed, 2 years from now we go, okay, we've paid everybody their wages like we said to, because we know there's enough money to do that, we're setting it aside. It's just not working. And we have to, if nothing else, the piece of property that we have should sell for a lot more than we paid for it. We should be able to recover 100%, if not all, of investors' money. As a founder that's coming in and able to buy the shares at a discount. And this would be true of the shares that, let's say, Joe or the tenant farmers, because they also have an opportunity to buy some shares at a discount. Before they get anything in recovery, 100% of what's recovered goes to the members that paid full price. Only if they're made 100% whole and anything's left over do the founding group get their investment back, if any, if at all. And I think that's fair, too, because we're turning to you and saying, believe in us and we'll go do this. You have control over whether or not you invest with us, but you do not have control over our day-to-day work ethic and our drive and our business decisions. You get some voting rights here and there, but in the end, we either make it or we break it. So if we take your investment and we break it, whatever's left when the dust settles should first go back to you. I don't know that anybody's ever set up a business that way before. I've never heard of it. I bounced it off my buddy Neil. He told me, you freaking insane, Jack. That's the best British accent I can do. But I don't think so. I think that if you do business with people that way, that when you need them, they'll be there for you because they know that you're looking out for them. And I think that if you want to build a business that can be, that can go into places where no one else is doing it, where no bank would give you the money, where conventional wisdom says it won't work, you have got to do business at a higher ethical level than could ever be done. Does that mean that there's no way to lose in this? No. That means that whatever losses there are, first go to the people that generally profit the most and risk the least. In this case, the losses first go to those who profit the most and risk the least. And then the losses are prorated across those who just stepped up and said, I want to be part of it. It's so counterintuitive, it's hard to even explain in this modern world. But I'll just ask you this, if you're considering whether or not this is something you want to be part of, is there any other place that would ask you to invest in something and treat you that way? and say, we'll take the losses first. I don't know of any. And wherever they do, it's because they're forced to by law. This is what we want to do because we believe it's right. I do think it will succeed. I've told you there's no guarantee, but I believe it will succeed or I wouldn't be doing it. The first thing is zero debt means very low overhead. Our overhead's all productive stuff. All things that are designed to make money for the farm long term, plus some wages. There's no lease fee. There's no mortgage. And there's no way we can lose the farm because all we have to do is at least pay the property taxes, which we can prepay for 2 years as part of our allocation of budget. So there's low overhead. Because we are going to put a living wage for our farmers, they have no stress. They're not going to get kicked out of their house. Right? They're not going to get kicked out of their house because it's our house. We're letting them stay in it. They're going to have enough money to exist. They have certainly an encouragement to do more. Their employment's not guaranteed. I mean, if I go over there one day and everybody's sitting around smoking meth, I mean, they're out, right? So there is some conditions to their contract, but as long as they're doing the job of farming, they're secure. And that means they can focus on farming. Our farmers today don't focus on farming. They focus on not going broke. I want to change that. The next reason I think it'll succeed, because the market for what we're going to produce is far in excess of what's available. I am not afraid to produce 1,000 Permaethos farms because the market's bigger than that. Most of the products that we'll be producing out of this stuff, I want to buy it and I cannot find it. I mean, that says something right there, doesn't it? That there's people trying to buy this stuff that can't even find it. So I know there's a market and I know we can produce what the market's asking for. And as far as problems from government, we're looking for land that's already zoned ag. Agriculturally zoned land. We're not going to buy a piece of land unless it's already zoned agricultural. What does that mean? That means when we move in, we can put chickens and ducks and you know, pork and start planting stuff and digging stuff up and ain't nobody can say nothing. You're farming there. It's a farm, stupid. It's a farm, stupid. We're not going to go into an area, buy a piece of land that's surrounded by an HOA that wants to annex us and starts complaining because goats stink. We're going to go buy a piece of land that's already used for farming, that already has horses walking around crapping on it, already has cattle walking around crapping on it, already gets dug up and gets dirty, a farm. So no interference from the man on the primary objective. Now, when we start looking at trying to convert it into kind of a, what you call like a micro eco village, we might run into some things we can adjust as we run into those. But the primary mission, grow food, we are actually, the people in the way of the community will actually tell us, you must grow food to maintain your agricultural exemption. Okay, you got me, I'll do that. So that's another reason I think it'll work. Here's what I need now. Number one, I need a good attorney. I would love if somebody out there that's an attorney in the state of Texas that has experience with contract law that could help me develop the shareholders agreement or tell me how to form that membership agreement and develop that contract so that I protect the company so that I protect the members. If I leave the company vulnerable, I'm putting every single shareholder and member at risk. This is something I think a lot of people struggle with. If a company really wants to protect itself and they're worried about protecting themselves, then what are they, you know, do they really care about their customers? Yeah. Do they really care about their investors? Absolutely. Because if one investor can find a loophole and use it to sue you, they can put the safety and security of every single other person that's invested alongside them at risk. So this has to be done in a way that basically says this is a high risk play. You're doing it of your own free will. You're not mortgaging your house to get the money. Here's what we said we'll do. We'll do everything in our power to be successful, and here's how we'll implement it. I need a good CPA. I've got another problem here. I think it can be solved, and it might have something to do with an attorney looking at this as well, and the CPA and the attorney working together, and that's tax implications. Let's say we sell our 1,000 shares at $500 a share. The IRS would turn around and say, oh, look what you've done. Right, you've made yourself a $500,000 profit. Please give us $200,000. Well, that was my operating budget. That's what I was going to pay my farmers with, buy my plants with, buy equipment with, improve the property with, put in housing with. So there has to be a way when fundraising like this to capitalize the money in as an investment. Because if I go and set up a company and put my own money into it, they don't tax that. So this has to be structured this way, and I've never used other people's money to do anything before. I've had small partnerships where we all put money in. I've never done anything like this before from this standpoint financially and legally. So I need to know how to do it right so the money is not dinged as a tax income. Because it's not an income. It's an investment. The income is the resulting profit off the investment. That may not be a big problem at all. I don't think it is, but I don't know how to set it up. So I would like somebody from the tax world, CPA type, hopefully in Texas, to help me set that up. And I would love to find, if you're an attorney and you know a good CPA that would be interested in this, or the other way around, you're a CPA that knows a good attorney, I'd like two guys that can work as a team on this. And I'd like to keep the cost of doing that as low as possible as part of the community and maybe give you a couple shares as part of your compensation and then say, long term, you're our guy. So then you bill us your rate to do your work like we would pay any attorney or any CPA, because I'm sure we're going to need both of you in the future, hopefully not too much. The next thing I need is I need investors that are more concerned about permaculture than profits. I don't want people investing as charity. I don't want you to say, you know what, I'll throw $2,000 at this. Here's $2,000. I don't care if I ever get a dime back because I'm just doing it for charity. I want you to want to make money. I want you to want to see a return of investment. I want you to feel that your money is better suited here than in a bank or in Exxon. I really do. But I want your primary objective to be what my primary objective is and to make this available. We sit around as a community all the time and we bitch about modern agriculture. We bitch about GMO. We bitch about the fact that farmers are broke and don't have another choice. We bitch about farm subsidies. We bitch about soil erosion. We bitch about chemicals. We bitch about the choices, about what's available from variety, about people not being able to make a go of it, about all the things government does to stand in the way of others. We say we want these things. I think I've figured out how to get them. I believe this is the best system in the world for growing communities and growing the food to feed them with. But I need people to invest that are more concerned about the objective than the profit. What I mean by that is I've always said in business, and I've always been successful in business, I'm not worried about the profit other than the basic business sense that goes along with building a profitable business. But I don't sit around and worry about the profit because I believe that when we do the right things, the profit will take care of itself. We're not in the business of making profit. We're in the business of serving customers. And when the customer's happy, they're happy to do business with you. And if things are priced properly and operations run effectively, profit's the natural result. When I plant a tree and I've given it all the fertility and moisture and soil balancing I can, I'm not worried whether or not it'll grow. I'm worried about providing its needs, and I know that it'll grow. That's the natural consequence of giving it what it needs. I don't have to question whether the tree will grow. Now, trees have grown for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years before human beings were on the planet. Trees grow. We know that. We know what they need to grow, so we concentrate on the needs. When I build a business, I concentrate on the business's needs. And I know that if I do that right, the natural result will be profit. So that's what I mean when I say I'm interested in investors that are more concerned about permaculture than profits. You know the profit will be there if we execute properly. So you're more concerned about the execution than the ROI. And I need tenant farmers. I've got a farm steward. His name's Joe. You'll like him if you don't know him already. But I need two people willing to spend at least a year at this, willing to work hard, get up early, sweat, and make very little money doing it. To be cold some days, hot other days, and to some days, honest to God, go, I don't know if this is worth it. And then charge through it and see it through to the other side. And then learn enough and realize this does work and this is how to do it. I need two very special people for that. And I'm going to need woofers. This is going to be a bigger job than three people can do. We need part-time volunteer labor to come and say, I'm going to work 3 weeks here, 4 weeks here, 6 weeks here. Whatever it is. And, you know, woofers are not going to be on this kind of like, okay, well, you're going to work 8 hours a day, 4 days a week. Basically, in a woofing application, you'll say, this is how much work I want to do. This is how many hours a day I'll give you. This is how many days a week I'll do it. And we'll look through all the applications. And whoever seems best for the positions that are available, we'll take them. And that means that when you get out there and you say, well, I'll do 4 hours a day work, 5 days a week while I'm here, and then I want to go fishing the rest of my time. Fine. So then you'll be attached to one of the tenant farmers as a woofer who will set up a schedule for you and say, this is what you're doing with your 20 hours. What you do otherwise, it's up to you. But just to be fair, don't you think we would take the person that wants to do 30 hours a week over the one who wants to do 20? Probably so. I missed something, though, when I was talking about your benefits. I don't think I said this. We will guarantee you a spot if you are a member as a woofer within reason. Within reason. If you say, I want to woof, and I want to work 1 hour a week and stay for 3 weeks, not going to happen. But if you've made a reasonable offer, 25 hours a week or something like that, and you want to stay for a couple weeks, and we're finalizing things, and somebody's got a gold star because they're also a investor member, and that's even one share, you go right to the top of the list. And then we only take our woofers from outside of that list when we've given everybody that wants that the opportunity. And it's time availability as well. If you want to do that in June, and we've already booked our woofers for June, and it's May, then it's not open. That doesn't mean we won't try to find a way to make it happen, but we got to feed our woofers and we got to provide housing. So that's the real bottleneck there, because trust me, we're going to want as much help as we can get. But I don't know, I can see some people saying, well, I'll feed myself, I'll show up, I'll sleep in a tent. I just want to be part of this. We're not going to turn that down, especially in the first couple of years. So that's something that's an additional thing. So here's where we're going from here. I'm hoping that I don't have to go out in the wild, so to speak, and find myself, as my dogs are upset about something, find myself an attorney and a CPA. I'd much rather have somebody that's listened to my show, that knows me, that knows this community, that is an attorney and CPA, contact me. So I'm going to give that a little bit of time before I go seeking referrals and try to find somebody. Or hopefully when I do hear from somebody, I'm like, yeah, they're good at what they do. And I don't go, well, he's an attorney, but he's not got a client one or never done this before. So hopefully I'll find those. What I'm going to do for you guys next, though, is I'm going to put together an application. An application to be a PermaEthos investor. It will be similar but different to the other ones that I've had up. I'm going to take those down for now, though we're not throwing away that information. We are keeping it. If something happens where we can go forward with the other concept, maybe concurrently with this, we'll try it. But for right now, that's on the shelf. Okay? And whenever it comes off the shelf, everybody that put their hand up that's still interested will go before anybody else. I will always keep my commitments to you. I gave you my word on that, so I'll keep it. This is a new thing. This will be basically, who are you? Where do you live? How do you know about us? Do you understand that this is a risk play? How many shares are you interested in purchasing? And where are you getting the money from? And I don't need, like, I have X numbers. No, I just, like, cash on hand. And the reason I have to do that is to protect myself. Because if I have somebody that's basically telling me, well, I'm going to, you know, borrow against my retirement account for this, nuh-uh. No, you're not. Not with my knowledge, you're not. You're going to at least lie to me, so I don't know. And I don't want you doing that either. I want people that are putting money into this venture to feel okay with what happens, no matter what it is. I want you to understand you're becoming a pioneer. And pioneers get arrows in the back. But they're the ones that have to go first so that the others will follow. I've built everything I've ever done on that model. I'm always willing to go first. And what's funny, here's what's funny, guys. When you go first, you're mocked, you're ridiculed, and people wait for you to fail. When you succeed, others follow you, and they never have the magic you did of going first into a space. And then they say, but he went first. It was easy for him. It's never easy to go first. But there's a huge reality behind first mover advantage. They're not totally wrong. It's not easy. But when you go first and you do it right, you do become dominant. You absolutely do become dominant. And it's almost impossible then for anybody to overtake you unless you back off and do it half-ass. If you stick with it, if you stick with building, it's almost insurmountable. And if you look at the survival podcast, guys, that's what I did. I went first, there was no one. Now there's dozens. And none of them have anywhere near the success of TSP or the magic of its community. The magic's not me. The magic's the people in the community. The things that happen, the relationships that are formed, the way people help each other, the way people show up. We have an email list for all the people that have come to events at the house. It's only for people that have been to events at my house, classes and stuff, and about 60 people on it. One guy recently posted, "I'm not coming to this next one because I lost my job and I can't afford to right now until I figure out what I'm going to do next in my life." Three people answered him within 10 minutes. "I know about this opportunity. Weren't you doing this? There's some places like that here. I can help you and introduce you to someone if you're interested." All three of them required him to move. He wasn't really hip with any of them right now at the moment. But that is the type of community we have. Somebody just mentions it aside, not "can you help me?" And people are like, "let me help you." It's because we went first. When you go first, you attract the best. You attract the people willing to take the risk with you, willing to believe alongside of you. The people that go second, they generally attract the people who only go after someone's gone first. And a lot of those people are really good people, but they just choose to join up with the people that already went first. When you go second and you do it on your own, you're just trying to pick up whatever's left. Man, I believe in what we're doing, and I want to go first. Hopefully a lot of you will want to come along with me. So keep an eye out in the next day or two for that application to show up. And if you want to be part of something special, please consider giving me your trust in this and being part of it. I'll give you more updates as they come.